Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Now, there was a long time ago in Japan, a man by the name of Ikkyu. And he wrote a long poem. And I'm going to read a little bit of it to you here. He's quite a guy. If at the end of our journey, there be no final resting place, how can there be a way to lose ourselves in? Shakyamuni, this is what they call Buddha, Shakyamuni, that mischievous creature, having appeared in the world, misled, alas, how many people? This is from a Buddhist. I mean, really great. The mind, what shall we call it? It is the sound of the breeze that blows through the pines in the India ink picture. The mind remaining just as it was born without any prayer becomes a Buddha. Tell a lie and you fall into hell. Then what will happen to Buddha who contrived things that don't exist? When I read something like this, I'm rather caught between a tremendous delight and an awe. There is such a depth, such a far-reaching depth in this little verse, and yet it has a humor, and it cuts right to the root. All the things that we believe that, really are non-existent, but we believe them, shum. So, and it goes from where we find ourselves, one could say to the very height or to the very depth or to this very here now, to be a Buddha, an awakened one. Not someone that's far away in the past or is going to come in the future, or not some idol that we could worship, just you, just me. Just us. Waking up to being Buddha. Yeah. To understand that state that we call Buddhahood, one must be awake. What is it in the person? What is it that is to be awake, that is to be awakened? What in you must wake up to be awake? It doesn't mean, just to wake up in the morning. There is something that must be awakened. And we are apt to say, well, I am. I have to wake up. Well, do you know who you're talking about when you say I am, I have to be awake? You're talking about an ego. The ego is going to wake up. Now, when whatever it is in you that is to be awakened, when it is awakened, what will you call it? What will you name it? What do you name it now? You know, when we're physically asleep and then physically awake, there is a difference. Wouldn't you say? You go to sleep and there's a difference when you're physically awake. And we say, you know, I was asleep. Or we can say, I am going to go to sleep. We never ever say, I am asleep. When we are awake, you know, we wake up from a sleep. Physically, psychically, we look around, you know. We are immediately, objectively, self-conscious. Here I am looking at the things. We are conscious of this world as object. You are conscious of yourself as object, as a thing, as an entity. I am this thing. I am this thing. An entity. This is the self. Yeah. Objective self-consciousness. It is a state in a broad spectrum. It is a state of consciousness. When you go to sleep, you are dead to this objective self-conscious state, right? Unless you dream. Yeah, and sometimes we say we're dead to the world. But you didn't die. You know, only to the world. Where do you go when you sleep? You don't die. Where do you go? Interesting little things. There is, in Zen, a phrase I like. Of course, there's a good many phrases in Zen that I like, but one in particular that I like is selling water by the river. And it's kind of a useless occupation. You know, anyone who wants water, he just goes down to the river with their buckets and they have all they want. You know, who wants to buy what's free? Selling water by the river. It's a stupid occupation. Telling people what they don't want to hear. Telling them that their minds are deluded. Telling them not to waste their time on false ideas and false paths. Telling them to listen. Telling them to pay attention. Telling them to look at themselves. And to look at themselves from within. They want to know the truth. Lao Tzu said, you know, you must come to know the unknowable. Selling water by the river. It's a strange thing, mostly. People do not want the truth. First of all, they think they already know it. That they already have it in their grasp. You know, so Saint Simeon, he wrote, in our incomprehensible self-deception. And we do. We deceive ourselves. Then we have, of course, another attitude of, as far as the truth is concerned, who needs it? Fear comes into the picture. Don't go near the water. I don't need what you're trying to sell me. You know, we have all read Jesus meets this woman by the well, and he says to her, I will give you water, living water, and you will never thirst again. Almost everyone has a degree of thirst, some more, some less, but it is in everyone. Do we go to the river? Do we go to the source? No. The ego is sort of in the way because it wants, and it wants all kinds of things. You know, it wants color, and it wants magic, and it wants excitement, because it is, after all, the emotions that give color to our lives. And some people really go out of their way to give color to their everyday existence. You know, they think they have a rather dull, drab life, so spice it up a little. Yeah, and give some color to it. Get emotional. You know, squabble a little, fight a little, dramatize everything. You got color. You know, now I can feel alive. And if I do this, then people will know how important I am. Everyone should know how good I am. We doll up our lives as if they were soap operas. And this is one reason so many people are caught in soap operas. Here's all this emotional stuff going on that's missing in my life. We listen to it long enough, we try to transfer it into our lives. We don't say this to one another, though. We don't say, let's color our lives. Let's have some excitement in our lives. No, we say, let's have a relationship. I want my illusions, you know. I'm going to try to make my dreams a reality. I'm going to make my fantasies a reality. Who needs the truth? But the moment a person becomes really interested in the truth and really wanting to know what the truth is, what one may think the truth is from what one has heard or what one has read, but what it really is, the pinnacle, the ultimate, that all-seeing eye in the cap of the pyramid. Once you decide that this is what you want, something happens. Now, there are many kinds of truths. So people will say, well, there isn't any such thing as ultimate truth. There is. But we have mathematical truths, we have scientific truths, we have this happened the other day and I know it to be true because I was there. You know, nature's truths. You know, your truth and my truth and, you know, all these things. But setting all of that aside, all these many truths set aside, to have interest in this ultimate truth, it's rather, in a way, you know, like saying, let that mind be in you, which was in Christ Jesus. Let that truth live, be in you. Now, to become interested, really interested in truth, in that ultimate truth, is to take oneself in hand and to make the effort to become an individual. Only you can do this. You have to make the effort. You have to step out from the crowd. Now, the crowd, the content of your psyche, to step away from one's conditioning, now, Jesus, you know, he said, and they've mistranslated it, he said, learn to hate your mother and your father. They didn't mean that at all. But to see them in you and to realize that, oh, yes, my mother did this. I can stand at the kitchen sink and peel potatoes and exactly the way my mother did it. See, to recognize this in oneself. To let the dead bury the dead, because all of that is nothing but a memory. The conditioning is of the past. To extricate this that is aware within us of, oh yes, this is exactly the way my mother did it. I'm aware of this happening. We call that consciousness, huh? I am conscious that I'm doing it the way my mother did it. To extricate consciousness from the feelings, from the thinkings, from our reactions, from our responses, from our conditioning. The consciousness, you cannot extricate yourself from it, because at this point in time, until you become an individual, it is the ego self, that is the pivot around which you operate. It is the consciousness that is important. The ego is a false self, you know, it's a pseudo self. Now, and we should follow this biblical adage of come ye out from among them and be ye therefore separate. We have been told this. It doesn't mean that you go live on the top of a mountain all by yourself and be all alone. No. This is something that's going on within you. And also, this process doesn't happen overnight. Just because this is the way you want it. But to separate the consciousness from all else is imperative. You can't go the rest of the way without that. And I will also say it's not easy. Now, this universe in which we find ourselves is an electric magnetic field. And within that field are many, 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 many other fields. And they are all dependent on each other. Now, all of these electromagnetic fields, all these many, 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 many energy patterns, all the whirls and the eddies and so on within this whole, can be called a state of consciousness. Let us say that there is a pattern of energy, a field, state of consciousness, which in Christianity is called paradise, is called the Garden of Eden. Other groups, maybe like the Theosophical Society, would call it the vegetative kingdom. Or a world or a realm. So there is a world of plants and flowers and trees and so on, and we call it the garden. It is a state of consciousness, garden consciousness. And Adam and Eve, they lived in that state. And they fell from that state. And they put upon themselves what they called animal skins. Lust, which there is not any of in the garden. Greed, which there is not any of in the garden. Selfishness, which there is not any of in the garden. And working all through that, they finally came to this objective self-conscious state that we now call man. Primitive man, way, way back when, primitive man worked very hard. You have no idea how hard primitive man worked over the ages, over the eons, to arrive at an objective self-conscious state. It just didn't drop on him. He worked at it. Years and years and years and years, generation after generation after generation after generation, worked so they could become objectively self-conscious because it was just the next step. So we have this vegetative state. We have an animal state. We have an objective self-conscious state. And we have a human being state. This vegetative state resides in all of us. It's still there. It's in the personal, but is called the personal unconscious. It is in the what is called the group soul or the race psyche. And it can be brought into objectivity. We can see it. We can feel it. We can be in it. Paradise. Now remember that there are two trees in this garden. One tree, which we know well, the tree of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. This is our dualism, subject, object, that we work so hard at. But we must return to this garden in order to eat of the fruit of the tree of life. There is a state of consciousness which we call the garden. Uncover that in yourself. Let it be. Don't shut it out. It's a tremendously wonderful place to be. You cannot imagine how wonderful it is. Allow it. So we have a personal unconscious, and there is also this group unconscious. And in this personal unconscious, the contents of it are things we have forgotten, which we have repressed, and which we have suppressed. Then we have what Carl Jung called the collective unconscious. Now, the content of this collective unconscious has never been in our objective consciousness. In our objective conscious state. The contents of this collective unconscious are called archetypes. Yeah. And they're the basis of our myth. The word archi, of course, comes from the Greek, which means beginning, or primitive, or ancient. Hmm? Archetypal, then, is the original pattern, or we could say it's a mold. And this is what Plato used, you know, with his world of ideas. There was the original idea, and then all the other ideas that followed that were not as perfect. In the world of archetypes, there is a perfect chair, and all the chairs that came after that were not perfect. This is Plato. That's what he got out of it. You play with it and see what you get with it. I'm not saying this is right or wrong, it's these perfect chairs, imperfect chairs. The content of your psyche is personal. The collective unconscious is not a personal acquisition. The archetypes therein have never been in objective consciousness, but they can appear. And they appear in dreams, or they can appear in a vision. They have very primitive motifs. And these archetypes, these motifs, are known to every race, at every time, at any time. They always are. They do not belong to this time, or the time to come, or the time that has passed. It belongs to all time. Belongs to the Chinese and the Siamese, as well as to the Russians and to us. People the world over, if you dream of an archetype, it is the same. You don't have to belong to a particular religion. The archetype that appears in a dream is the same to all. It is not something that we have developed, it is something we have inherited. You know, well, let me tell you maybe about a dream. Let us say there is a body of water. And in this water, there's nothing else in this world, in this dream, except water. So we're at the bottom of the ocean or someplace like that. And in the ocean, in this body of water, sitting there on two thrones are a man and a woman. So here we now have now the basic male and female, or masculine and feminine. Hmm? And we can say of him that he is the Yellow Emperor. And she's a wise old woman. And they're sitting there, and this huge fish comes swimming by, and they recognize him. Hmm? They recognize that this huge fish is a symbol for the Christ. Now, this was a symbol for the Christ before Jesus Christ was born. In India, let us say, like 20,000 years ago, Krishna came out of the ocean as a fish. The fish is a symbol of Christ and of Krishna and all that has gone in between. You realize that before we make our actual appearance here on this earth, when we are in the mother's womb, we live in water. What lives in the water? We are very akin to fish. Now, say we take ourselves in hand and we go all through this transformation and then we become individual. At this point, we step out of the group soul. At that moment, we could say we are a self, not a permanent self, but a self. We are now responsible for ourselves, more so than we have been. Now, responsibility is something we should and we could practice. Responsible for myself, for where I find myself. For instance, we go to a place, could be any place, any church, any temple, a place, you know. And we could ask ourselves, do we go just to enjoy the amenities? When you go and you sit down in a place, do you realize that a place has been prepared for you? And what went into that preparation? You don't just come and use. You assume a responsibility. It is your responsibility to those who have come before you and prepared this place, and it is your responsibility to those who will come after you and whom you will never know. It is also, this kind of responsibility is also an acknowledgement to the Christ within you, or the Buddha within you. That you are willing to seek for this truth, and you are willing to assume your place. Now, the activity of living. Day by day, doing this, not doing that. All the things that we go through, this activity, before we become individual, is part and parcel of the group soul, or the race psyche, as they sometimes call it. Then we come across this word, karma, which means activity. The activity that you do today, what you do tomorrow, and what you don't do, and so on. The activity of living in a group soul is called karma. To whom does this karma belong? The ego? Oh, but the ego is eventually going to die. Then what about the karma? On whose shoulders does it fall? I mean, if there is a group, let us say there is a small group out in the Pacific Ocean somewhere, they live on a little island, and this little group, and everybody becomes individuated. What happened to the karma? What happens to it? You're going to leave the group soul, and your karma is going to fall on somebody's shoulders. You're going to endow it to somebody? I mean, if you could. Now, this consciousness that has become separate makes a journey. It goes all through the psyche, all through the psychic world, and finally it stands upon this glassy sea. We call it a self now. This self knows no karma, has never engendered any karma, and never will engender any karma. And it doesn't make any difference, good karma, bad karma, whatever you want to call it. Most people don't even know whether karma is good or bad. You know, we live our lives trying to get rid of karma, and all the time we're sieving it up as fast as we can. put it that way. You know, in all of this milieu, this our life, our activity of living, suddenly, through an experience, you have a transformation. You are transformed. You know, you're out of the pot, so to speak. You become an individual. What happens to your karma? I mean, if you're going to just give it to somebody else, all your bad karma, that makes you a bad person, doesn't it? If you're going to follow this logically, with the morality, then, you know, give it some thought. To what or to whom are you endowing? If you could. You know, we should be a little careful. A lot of things swim by us. We don't have to swallow it all. Reason. Who was it that said, let us reason together? Yeah. Investigate. You got a mind? Use it. And it's very interesting, I think, in my opinion, about Buddhism. It is a religion of the individual. Each one becoming free. Each one becoming awake. And it says, Buddhism says, we are already free. But we're not awake to it. And if the end of our journey, there be no final resting place, how can there be a way to lose ourselves in? See, so he's following this thing of the grave is not the goal. Now, we in this Western culture, by and large, you know, we have this idea that eventually we're going to rest in heaven. This is going to be our rest. Yeah. So we're going to live life so that when we die, when we depart the scene, we will receive our reward for being good. In which other words, they're just trying to tell you, assume your responsibility, be good. And if you don't do it right, you have sinned. And you will not rest in hell. That's what they tell us. You have sinned. You are at fault. See, this is a moral thing. And we also have been told that sin is an offense against God. Now, the word sin is the 21st letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And it means to miss the mark. And there is a Greek word, and the Bible was eventually written in the Greek, and the Greek word is hamartano, and it also means miss the mark. Okay. So we have like St. Paul who said, the good which I would do, I do not, and the evil which I would not, that I do. I miss the mark. Hamartano. Hamartano. I miss the mark. Now, what about this mark that we keep missing? When we read the Bible, the scriptures, we see that a great deal of Christ's teachings are in parables, like the anecdotes in Zen. And we find this in every religion. The teachings are veiled. And the disciples come to Jesus and they say to him, why speakest thou to them, that is the multitudes, in parables? And he answered and said unto them, because it is given unto you to know the mysteries of the kingdom, but to them it is not given. In other words, there are two kinds of teachings, one immediate to the disciples and one for the multitudes. And then he goes on to say, for to whomsoever hath, to him shall be given, and he shall have more abundance. But whomsoever hath not, from him shall be taken away, even that he hath. Therefore speak I to them in parables, because they seeing, see not, and hearing, hear not, neither do they understand. Now that's in Matthew. A very difficult situation. A teacher, let us say, talks very straight to a student. Or maybe also in parable. Yeah. Also, there is a difficulty in here. I have met very few, almost no one, come right down to it, who put themselves in a position that I am one of those who seeing, see not. We interpret what we read according to our state of consciousness. And we say, well, this is it. Well, I know what it's all about. At the same time, we know full well, because we are not really stupid, no matter how much we pretend to be. We know that we are not complete in our knowing. We are not complete in ourselves. We know this. And yet it comes as a kind of a shock that we have to learn to unlearn. There is a lot of us about us that has to be stripped away. And only in this way can we go through a transformation. We cannot take what we are now with us into the transformation. The transformation, the hitting the mark. Transformation, the mark that we must not miss. Not missing the mark. Now, which has a lot of very deep implications. It's not just a willy-nilly thing to go into. We, you and me, and everybody else, we come into this type of thing, this work, as it's sometimes called, with certain beliefs, and we have certain aspirations. We have aspirations as to what we want and what we expect to happen. And we say, well, I want to be free from fear. I want to be happy. I want to have a better job. I want to have more lovers. I want to have a better car. I would like to be more aggressive out there in the world. I want to be more objective. Excuse me. Are these the things that are on your agenda? Then what does transformation really mean? Now, the aims that you have now, sitting there, belong to you as you are now. In hitting the mark, you will have to change. Your desires will change. What about your beliefs? Will they change? If you hold on to the same aims and the same beliefs and the same ideas and the same plans and the same interpretations, you will continue to be the same person. There is no transformation. You will keep right on missing the mark. Maybe how you are now, you say to yourself, well, I'm an unhappy person. But you like all the rest about you. And you say, well, I want to stay just exactly as I am now, except that I want to be happy. Maybe that's not possible. You know, the old story of the butterfly is so apropos. You know, we have all these stages of growth. And one stage, of course, is the larva. And the larva, you say, I want to grow. See? And in our minds, growing means becoming a bigger, happier, fatter, more colorful larva. Doesn't it? Huh? We don't reason with ourselves that I'm going to be something totally different. Well, why don't we do that? Basically, because we don't want to be anything different. Huh? We want to be bigger, more beautiful, more handsome, more loving, more fatter, more larva. Yeah. The concept of butterfly never enters the picture. No. It's nowhere near our thinking. That instead of crawling, I'm going to fly. It's a problem, you know? We're growing. You know, larva grows. We're growing. We're in a stage of growing. We have not reached the end. And primitive man, you know, took, as I said, centuries to reach a state of objective self-consciousness. Now we're growing to another state. This objective self-conscious state is growing. And in growing, you know, every now and then we find something's wrong. We're not complete. Something's wrong. So we complain and we go to a therapist. Something's wrong. Well, the therapist says change a little here and change a little there and don't eat so many maple leaves because it'll give you indigestion. And then, you know, they're right for a while. And maybe we go to a chiropractor and have some of the joints straightened out. Or we go to a masseuse and get relaxed. You know, or we go to a doctor and he says, there's nothing wrong with you. Huh? It doesn't seem to occur to the larva that it's not going to feel any better as long as it continues to be a larva. It's supposed to be a butterfly. We have to allow this to emerge. We have to go through a transformation without anticipation as to how it should happen or what it should be. You can't think what it's going to be. You can only direct things as you are now. If you're going to be something, grow into something other than larva, you've got to let that, this is my way, do it my way, do it my way. You've got to let that go. I understand this, and I understand that, and I understand that. Let it go. It belongs to you as you are now. And if you hang on to it, that's what you're going to be, what you are now. Not even fatter and prettier or whatever, just what you are now. You know, you pays your money and you takes your choice. I've always said that. And you do pay. You have dues in life. You work for what you get. always. And you decide, well, it's too difficult. I won't do it. You know? So at the end of your life, what have you got? A larva or a butterfly? Well, if you're a larva, where is the butterfly? Where is this butterfly? He's hiding in you, just exactly where he is now. Yeah? At this very moment, think of it, at this very moment, not a thing is lacking. All you have to do is wake up. Just wake up. We're back to the original question I asked. What is it in you that must wake up? Wake up. That's why you're here, living in this world. Wake up. And now may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.